There is no one called Freddie Jones in the Freddie Jones band, but we won't hold it against them because they put out some great music, including that song from 1992 called In a Daydream. It's a great tune. If you haven't heard it in a while, check that out. We're talking with the Nano Man, Chris Cooper, and filmmaker Jeremy Corbell, and we've already heard some pretty astonishing things so far about the discovery of this stuff called utility fog, in which titanium nanobots are shown under electron microscopes, and that this sample, this amazing stuff, was obtained from a crop formation that our guest Chris Cooper was present along with five other people when this thing sort of formed around them, that it sort of opened his eyes to other possibilities and has been a factor in his research that's led to, among other things, a space drive system that the Pentagon was interested in for a while. But there's one more, a big development that we have only hinted about, and that deals with cold fusion. And we're going to jump into that in just a moment, and we'll save a little bit of time at the end for you to ask a couple of questions of our guests. Much more to come here in this final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Jeremy Corbell, I'm going to let you set up this this audio clip we're about to hear. I'm not sure if you knew when you started working on the project with Chris Cooper that his research would take you into the area of cold fusion, or what your general knowledge of cold fusion was. I know that in general, you know, for a while we had what looked like a breakthrough by those guys, Fleischmann and Pons, and then suddenly it was discredited, and it seemed like the whole thing went away or went underground or behind the scenes. But, you know, in the public eye, it probably seemed to have been a pie in the sky. So why don't you set up the clip we're about to hear, and what was going on as you're working on this part of the project?
Yeah, I mean, all of this has been a scientific learning curve for me with a lot of my films, with Patient 17 and all of my work with Chris Cooper. You know, you realize you do a lot of sitting around waiting for something to happen when you do a documentary. This experience was fantastic. We had spent a number of days talking about these breakthroughs that Chris was having with a number of other scientists working on cold fusion. I mean, I must add, in 2007 to Lawrence Livermore, you know, Chris did achieve workable cold fusion, but he really wants to commercialize it and he wants to upscale it. So we're there and we're going to the laboratory I think it was 2 days before we're supposed to go to this laboratory. And, you know, he's saying, well, you know, we're going to have this breakthrough, I'm sure, you know, we've got it to a level now. And I said, well, I have to film something. It's a visual medium. And that's when the idea of the light bulb came on. Well, if we can illuminate something, it's going to really show visually the audience that, you know, your reaction has possibilities, you know, because to me, cold fusion was this, you know, kind of concept way outside of myself. The way it could transform the world is so significant. So there I am. And his father had put together this electronics package that would be able to take the temperature differential and turn it into electric power if, indeed, we achieved on that day a true cold fusion reaction. And so there we are, and he sets it up, and it's just like one of those scientific days. You're like, oh, bummer, it didn't work. So we're sitting there for about an hour, and they're tinkering with getting the wiring right. And so I just start filming other stuff. I'm shooting B-roll of all this strange Frankenstein equipment that's in this house. And then as my camera is just filming some device in another room, you're going to hear Chris, you know, screaming. He's like, Jeremy, I can't believe it. So it was this incredible opportunity where just the camera happened to be rolling, you know, right when this happened. So that's the audio clip you're going to hear. And I have a full video of this diode being lit, which we think is the first time a light bulb has ever been engaged through true cold fusion. So this is a kind of monumental, historic moment, and you'll hear the audio and the excitement of my really nerdy friend who I love dearly, Chris Cooper. You know?
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's play it. Play it, and then we'll talk about it.
Oh, my God. Jeremy, it's working. Oh my God, there it is, come around.
I'm not gonna touch it.
Go ahead.
It's blinking.
Where is it?
It's blinking, right over here, you have to come around.
Real
electric power, there we go.
Oh my God, holy shit. It really is working.
Okay, can I get a light on?
You did it.
Hold on, can I get a light on here?
Oh my god.
Okay, hold on, guys.
Okay. Oh, man. Okay, oh my god.
I got a picture of the thing.
I want to get Chris freaking out.
Molly's all excited.
I can't believe this.
No.
You get one fusion reactor with net power that's
infinite.
Lighting a light that's infinite power, and he gets excited.
Go figure. Dennis, this is bigger than the atomic bomb. You know that. You even said it yourself.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
It's a little bitty thing.
Yeah, a little bitty thing.
The sphere is about the size of the uranium core
right.
of the bomb.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, hold on. I'm going to need some explanation.
You want to see the thing, right?
Oh, my God.
So that's the audio clip. Jeremy's going to post the video and audio on his website, extraordinarybeliefs.com. Chris, walk us through that. How did you do it? Is it replicatable? And what does it mean?
So the experiment was conducted in a completely enclosed sphere of brass. Inside the sphere was the material, the cold fusion catalyst, in an atmosphere of hydrogen and deuterium. And this is the most remarkable cold fusion experiment I've ever seen, because there is no input power. And what that means is that there the coefficient of performance is basically a ratio of power in to power out. But in this case, there's no power in. The whole thing is at room temperature, and the device is at an elevated temperature. So it's a COP, a coefficient of performance, is infinite. Zero power in and real measurable power out. Now, it's still the most extraordinary day of my scientific life to actually see a electronic harvesting circuit harvesting enough actual electric power from a set of Peltier devices around the outside of the sphere, and it was able to actually collect that thermal power. Moving through the Peltier, convert that to electric power. The energy harvesting circuit would collect enough of that power to then light up an LED, and it would flash the LED about once every second or so. And as far as I know, that experiment demonstrating thermal to electric conversion on a cold fusion device that required zero input power had never been done before.
Chris, I mean, so this changes cold fusion.
To be one of the most significant experiments in cold fusion, and in my experience, it may very well be the most significant experiment in cold fusion of all time.
I mean, it changes everything. Cold fusion changes everything, right?
Absolutely. There's a zero environmental impact. There is no radiation, and the byproduct of cold fusion is helium, and helium is a harmless gas that is used to inflate weather balloons. It's used to inflate balloons at a party. So absolutely benign, environmentally friendly, and inexhaustible.
I would think that if I had made that breakthrough, that's all I'd be working on. Even though your other stuff is all very interesting, that when you look at the ultimate potential of cold fusion, that's my entire energy would be devoted there.
So my current energy is devoted toward a carbon-based material that is conductive
has extremely high surface area, etc. And so the materials that I'm currently working on, scaling up the manufacturing, this carbon nanotube thread and cable, is one of the potential products for this material I'm working on, is cold fusion.
So it's all kind of related, cold fusion, space drive, carbon nanotubes. It's all the same project, just different aspects of it.
It all uses the same platform technology.
Jeremy, I mean, you've got that on film. It seems like that would be really big news.
Well, it's the first time anybody's hearing about it. I mean, you know, a lot of what I've filmed is behind by a year or a couple years. I mean, you know, you need to film it, you need to edit it. I do everything myself. So, you know, this is our first opportunity to kind of announce to the world that, you know, Chris has, in his work with a number of other cold fusion scientists, achieved something that is truly remarkable and a first. And yes, it's captured on film, and there's more to come on that. You get a little 5-minute free piece, and then I'm going to edit the rest of that entire series on cold fusion. So I'm very excited. I mean, this is a first to announce it on Coast.
And Chris, I mean, do you publish on that? Do you have any plans to share it with colleagues in some other forum or venue?
My primary interest is to get these technologies commercialized, and viable commercialization path is through the standard raise money, build the team, do the heavy lifting it takes to really optimize the process, optimize the material, and get it ready for prime time. So I prefer to speak quietly and work diligently and deliver real products, whereas when one looks at the current state of cold fusion, there's a lot of people talking about it and very few people actually doing anything about it. So there's plenty of people being very vocal, and it's just not my style, I suppose.
You mean people flapping their gums and not really doing the heavy lifting?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me this. No, so, you know, you've shown that it can happen, that it can be done in a lab.
Yes.
And if your work is in the carbon nanotube area as a way to enhance that kind of research, can you protect the work that you've done, patent it, or otherwise, you know, prevent it from just being stolen from you? Or I would imagine you want to share it with humanity at some point.
Yes, in fact, the carbon nanotube cold fusion work that I've done has been patented and was verified at Lawrence Livermore National Labs.
It was?
Yes.
And is it published? Is it out in the general scientific community? Is it known?
No, it's not. It was a work for others contract back in 2007, and I have been far more focused on just the heavy lifting of commercializing these technologies, and a lot less focused on publication and so forth.
Well, I would imagine that even though with this breakthrough that you've made, that making a practical application of cold fusion, putting it into a commercial point would take an enormous amount of resources.
Yes. However, there's enormous leverage that can be achieved through modern technology. What used to take incredible resources. Back when I was commercializing the carbon nanotube filter material, where we had to hire, dozens of scientists to do the optimization of those materials, today is really much more suited toward automated materials discovery.
So Jeremy,
surprisingly, it takes less resources if the technology around you is advancing at the rate that it currently is.
Who else is doing good stuff, good work on cold fusion, Chris?
Oh, there's a number of groups doing really good work in the field of cold fusion. Researchers, there are probably two dozen researchers that are currently in laboratories doing really groundbreaking work in this field. The work of Peter Hagelstein, a professor at MIT, has made significant breakthroughs in the theoretical underpinnings of cold fusion.
And Jeremy, your plans for the material you have, it's more than one film project, but your work with Chris, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's 3 to 4 primary film projects. So yeah, I've been following Chris for a number of years. So just now I'm going to be able to release the second episode in the Nanoman series called Space Drive. And that's actually in February. It's going to premiere at the International UFO Congress. And at that night, which is mid-December, it will be available as the second episode for people to download and watch. And, that's my goal, is to slowly churn out these different episodes about Chris's work. So now, obviously, I have to get into and cut the cold fusion piece into its full glory because people now know about it. So each piece just kind of comes out like that. So we have cold fusion, space drive, the utility fog, if I can get a part two on that, and then also the work that Chris is doing with carbon nanotubes and the weaving of these materials, which have incredible properties.
Chris, the other voice we heard in that audio clip, we heard Jeremy and we recognize your voice. The other voice was your father. Tell me about his role in the work that you guys are doing. It must have been a really proud moment for him as well.
Actually, that was the voice of one of our other scientists who been working in the field of cold fusion since before Pons and Fleischmann. And he was doing work in the field of cold fusion for the U.S. Air Force long before Pons and Fleischmann.
Well, that was still a pretty exciting moment for him then. You've had conversations since then with him.
Yes, he is. We are continuing to collaborate on bringing this this effect and this technology to commercial levels of power production.
And Chris,
well, let me ask you about your father then, because I had assumed in seeing those video clips that that's who we were seeing, but is he involved directly in this part of the work?
Yes, my father has been involved in this research and was even joined me for campaigns out at Lawrence Livermore in 2007. He's an accomplished electrical engineer, worked at White Sands Missile Range, and is very good at building feedback control systems.
Well, he must have been pretty proud of when he heard that news. When we come back, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to open up the phone lines with your questions for my guests, Jeremy Corbell and Chris Cooper, Nanoman, whether it's about interstellar travel and the space drive, the utility fog, nanobots, perhaps that crop circle experience that we heard about in the last hour, a pretty amazing series of events. We'll open up the phone lines, whatever is on your mind. Bonnie Raitt, Love Me Like a Man, putting her cards on the table. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. It's been so cold over so much of the country, and while it isn't nearly as bad here in the desert, I've already had enough of winter. I'm sure you have too, and we're all mentally and musically ready for a beach somewhere. So that's Kenny Chesney sort of picking up the baton from Jimmy Buffett, running with it or strolling down a sandy beach somewhere, his song When the Sun Goes Down. We're talking with Chris Cooper and Jeremy Corbell about some pretty amazing scientific and technical developments that could change pretty much everything as we know it. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines with your questions or comments for our guests here on Coast to Coast AM. Our final segment of a very interesting show here on Coast to Coast. Jeremy, before we go to the phones, I know that you had some interaction with Chris's dad and have some reflections on how proud he is and the kind of exotic work that the father has done as well as the son.
Yeah. His father is really incredible, and the way they work together is really unique. And I remember coming home from the diode or the light bulb experiment, and you know, his father was just wanting to know, like, did it work? Did it work? Did we achieve it? And I said, well, yeah, it worked. We achieved it. You know, how big is this scientific discovery? And he's a really thoughtful, quiet man of a few words. And he turned to me, and he's never really this open, and he turned to me and he says, you know, this is this experiment is on par with the discovery of fire. And when he said that, it really struck me that a man of his credentials and his scientific rigor would go that far and say that this was that important, this discovery, and I surely hope it is.
Well, it must be something fun to talk about around the family dinner table, Chris.
Yes, it is.
Let's take a couple of calls. First-time caller, Billy in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Billy. Hi, you're welcome to Coast to Coast. Are you there? What's on your mind? All right. Is it Billy, the first-time caller? Hi, Billy. Are you there? Hello? All right. I'm going to try this one more time. Is there a Billy in New Orleans, Louisiana on the line with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What's on your mind, Billy?
I wanted to know. I wanted to thank you for taking my call. It's really a great show tonight. And I wanted to know if cold fusion technology can be used in automobiles and if your guests would be kind enough to build me one.
So is there an application in transportation?
Yes. In fact, the scientist you heard during the clip is currently installing an electric motor into a Model A Ford and intends to drive this vehicle across country solely powered by his cold fusion device, and I'm supporting him in that work as well.
Yeah, Jeremy, you're going to have to talk him into letting you bring a camera along for that trip.
Oh, I already have had that conversation. It was something I was not allowed to talk about, but since Chris talked about it, going into that garage and seeing that old Ford and then thinking about it being run on cold fusion, I am sitting in that passenger seat.
Well, Billy, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. We'll go east of the Rockies. Tammy, also in Louisiana. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. Thank you. Jeremy?
Yes.
Hi. Thank you. My dad was also Air Force, and I had my experience with triangular aircraft and some lights I wanted to tell you about. Maybe you have some insight. And I'm thinking three's a charm, and I don't have video camera or anything like that. And I'm thinking three's a charm, and I will just walk into it instead of this century-solving thing. It'll be less than a decade. But I want to tell you my phenomenon and see what your insight is on it, on light.
Well, yeah, I mean, thank you for calling. It's coast-to-coast listeners like you that call in that make this really exciting for us, because we often learn about new cases and about new things we didn't know about before. So feel free to contact me after the show and tell me more in detail your experience. But, you know, here's the deal. There have been lights in the sky with propulsion abilities far beyond anything humanity has had, way before black projects, way before any secret military. These things have been engaging humanity through technology. So your experience, I can't say one way or the other what it is, but I can tell you, you are not alone, that a lot of people have seen things that seem to defy the fundamental physics of gravity and the physics as we know them. And there is a real phenomenon. It has been occurring far before, probably before recorded human history, but that's as far back as we go. And, you know, anybody that thinks not, they just haven't done the research. They just haven't looked into it. So I encourage you to reach out to me, tell me your story in full, and if there's something that I can illuminate or study, I will. So thank you for your call.
Well,
thank you.
If I walk into it, I'm just going to walk into it.
I'll tell you what. We're not going to take just UFO incident calls. I appreciate you calling. We're glad you're part of the audience, but that's not what we're doing and covering tonight. But thank you for the call. We're going to try Steve on the wild card line. He's calling in from Albany, New York. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good evening. I got a question, or question. Well, I'll throw something out here. Have you ever heard of buckyballs?
Yes. In fact, my master's thesis at the University of Washington was on buckyballs. That was back in 1994.
Yeah.
An extraordinary material, but very, very, so far, very difficult to commercialize. Because the carbon nanotube has many of the same properties as a buckyball, and because it's in a format of a fiber instead of a ball, same exact carbon structure, I decided to basically pursue carbon nanotube commercialization.
Okay, with buckyballs, you could infuse certain elements and create almost superconductance. Could you do this with the carbon fibers? Or whatever happens
yes.
with superconductance. I went into the Navy about 1986, and there was a big thing about superconductance, and then you never heard of it again. And I was wondering, if you're using carbon tubes, and you both use buckyballs and these elements, I can't remember what they were using. You could probably, come up with some more materials and, get electricity cheaper.
Yes, in fact, I have come across papers in the literature where people have been able to synthesize peas in a pod. So you have a carbon nanotube on the outside with a buckyball filling the inside of the nanotube. Extraordinary structures, and there have been many papers disclosing the superconducting properties of those materials. Again, extraordinarily difficult to fabricate, and even harder to separate from other types of carbon materials. I think that these are all structures that will lead to a continuing technological revolution in nanotechnology as myself and others learn how to really harness the synthetic processes for making those structures.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Appreciate it. We're going to go to Ed in Connecticut on the wild card line. Ed, how you doing?
For you. Thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure.
I have a question for you, Chris. Pretty much a two-part about these nanobots. In regards to their specific capabilities, A, do you believe that they could be used in a vehicle to disrupt the bearings of a rear-wheel drive vehicle? There's bearings in the front wheel. Could they disrupt that mechanically while in use? And or maybe neither B, could they be used to have somebody do something beyond their control, maybe if they're on some type of antidepressant drug or something along those lines, or not some type of medication.
A little far-fetched. If indeed what I've seen in the field is a form of utility fog, if this material is in our environment, many possibilities may exist in terms of things we don't understand. Was certainly a time when people got sick and we had no theory of bacteria or virus to explain why people got sick. There may be many many strange anomalies that could be this could be the cause. Very difficult to hunt down, particularly if it's if it is utility fog and doesn't want to be found. It would be extraordinarily difficult to extract from the environment unless it was willing to let you study it.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ed. That raises some interesting possibilities, that's for sure. We're going to go west of the Rockies. Scott in Folsom, California, who is not a big fan of cold fusion. Scott, hi.
Yeah,
you're
hi,
on
guys.
With Chris and Jeremy.
Yeah, the thing is about what he's probably doing is he's probably doing some sort of unknown chemical reaction. It's not cold fusion, because the reason that you have to put energy in to get fusion is because the atoms are tightly held together by very powerful forces. And I'm sure he knows that as a physicist. I've had several physics classes myself, and I've talked to all the professors about it. The first thing I do is I ask them about cold fusion. And they all say it's got to be a chemical reaction, because it may be an unknown chemical reaction. I will grant them that, and I'm not saying he's doing a fraud, but it's not conventional physics to be able to fuse atoms together. It's just because they're held together for a reason. That's why you got an atom. There's very powerful forces, electrical forces holding those atoms together to the nucleus, and you're not going to fuse them and pull them apart and fuse them and like he's talking about. And so I don't think that's what he's doing.
Okay. Good point,
and
Scott.
I would like
Let's
him to explain
yes.
it.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. We'll let him.
That is a very good point. And to tell you the truth, I suspect many cold fusion experiments out there are in fact chemical reactions. So in order to separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will, you also really need to look for other key signatures. So one of the things that we found from actual cold fusion experiments, and it's a difficult measurement to make, is that you will see, often you will see soft X-ray from the reaction. Of course, in virtually all of these cold fusion experiments, they're inside a container that will absorb the soft X-rays. The other thing that you'll see when a cold fusion experiment goes sideways, or you do not have enough atoms in the process, you can see some gamma rays from time to time come from these experiments, and this type of radiation can't come from classic chemistry. In terms of the overcoming the Coulomb barrier, the atoms are very tightly held together. I would refer you to some of the work that Peter Hegelstein has done from MIT, and he has gone through just an extensive amount of research analyzing cold fusion experiments and coming up with what appears to be a pretty unified theory as to exactly how one can overcome these almost impossible barriers to creating this effect. So I agree, and I was a skeptic, a very strong skeptic of cold fusion up until this point when years ago at Lawrence Livermore, we were going through the data with some of the scientists from Livermore, and it was the scientists at Livermore who had to convince me that what we were doing was actually cold fusion. So so I hope that answers your question.
Thanks, Scott.
Well,
that was a very legitimate point.
Good information I can follow up on. Thank you.
Yeah, great. It was a great point. And I think also as a follow-up to what Scott was saying is, you know, at some level, the accepted view in the general scientific community is exactly as he described it, is that cold fusion is not possible. I guess cutting-edge stuff, the folks at your level see it differently.
Yes, that's right. There are top scientists out there at top institutions like MIT and Livermore that believe it is absolutely possible within the rules of physics.
Are you then, Chris? Are you optimistic in the long run, the big picture? So much of the news that we hear is bad. What's happening to the planet and Stripe doesn't seem to be a way out. There's so much that seems to be going wrong. Are you generally optimistic if some of these things to come to fruition?
Oh, absolutely. We are just on the verge of a new technological revolution with all of these technologies. And you'll often see a great deal of pessimism shortly before a new renaissance. And I see a whole new renaissance in science and technology coming at us with a full gale force. And it will take economics professors and Wall Street by surprise. The cost for achieving these breakthroughs in science are dropping rapidly, as we see sort of exponential computational technology aid folks in private laboratories around the world who have very little resources, but suddenly access to powerful technologies to help them push the edge of science further.
We have about a minute left. Jeremy, I want to give you a chance to tell us what you're working on and what comes next. We have links to your extraordinarybeliefs.com website and also to Chris's sites, and I hope our listeners, skeptical and otherwise, will check those out. But very quickly, what you've got on the horizon, and then I'll give Chris the last word.
Yeah, so I'm speaking at the International UFO Congress with the great Jacques Vallée. Definitely check that out. And then I'll be speaking at Contact, which is a really cool thing in my neck of the woods. Definitely check those out. I would encourage everybody to go to Chris's websites. What I have seen Chris achieve and what I have seen him do as an incredible scientist is unparalleled. Sometimes it looks like magic. It's really worth checking out. Skeptic or not, we invite you all. Go to Chris's websites, learn about what he's doing, and try to become part of this solution. And so that's my last word. Thanks for having me on. And Chris, go ahead.
Well, thank you so much also for having me on. It's been a real pleasure for the last 3 hours. And I would encourage everyone to check out Jeremy's documentary work. He is an extraordinary film and cinematographer. The work he puts together is extraordinary.
Chris, thanks for being here and being so candid. Thanks, Jeremy, as always. I'll talk to both of you again. Thank you to my colleagues there at Coast, Jeff DeRay, Juan Velasquez, G. Lee, Dan Galani, our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, producer Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp, and I'll be back next Sunday night with Mr. UFO Hunter himself, Bill Burns. Hope you can join us then. Good night, everyone.